You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading for Council Bluff Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, September 22nd. I am Harrison Futrell from Drake University, and here is our first story. Our first story for the day is Trump to make court pick by Saturday, Ginsburg serves set by Jonathan Lemire, Lisa Macaro, and Alexandria Jaff. President Donald Trump said Monday he expects to announce his pick for Supreme Court justice on Friday or Saturday, after funeral services for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and just days before the first presidential election debate. Ginsburg's casket will be on public view Wednesday and Thursday at the iconic steps outside the court building to allow the public mourning during the coronavirus pandemic. On Friday, Ginsburg will lie in state in the Capitol Sanctuary Hall in a ceremony opened only to invited guests, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said. The court said Ginsburg will be buried next week at Arlington National Cemetery in a private service. Trump told Fox and Friends that he had a list of 5 finalists, probably 4, and that he's pushing for confirmation vote before Election Day. Democrats vigorously opposed that, pointing to the hypocrisy of Republicans for rushing through the picks so close to the election after refusing to do so months earlier for President Obama back in 2016. Dismissing the argument, Trump said the rapid nomination and confirmation, "I think it would be good for the Republican Party, and I think it would be good for everybody to get it over with." The impending clash over the vacant seat, to fill it and with whom, has scrambled the sketch run for the president's race for a nation already reeling from a pandemic that has killed nearly 200,000 people, left millions unemployed, and a heightened partisan tensions and anger. Democratic nominee Joe Biden has urged a delay in nominations, declaring that the next president should fill the seat. Ginsburg, age 87, died Friday of metastatic pancreas cancer. Trump discouraged reports that Ginsburg had told her granddaughter that it was her wish that replacement justice not be confirmed until the inauguration of a new president. Trump floated a far-flung theory that he thought his Democratic political foes were behind the report, including Representative Adam Schiff, who led the House impeachment probe, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. Schiff's office said Monday it had no immediate comment. The president and his fellow Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who will control the timing of the confirmation hearing and the vote, has pushed back against the 2016 comparison, knowing that Trump could win again and saying that, unlike 4 years ago, the same political party controls both the White House and the Senate. "We have the presidency and the Senate, and we have plenty of time," Trump said. Trump allowed that he would accept a vote in the lame duck period after Election Day, but made it clear his preference would be that it occurred by November 3rd. The president criticized Republican Senator Susie Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska for opposing a vote before elections, warning they would be very badly hurt by voters. McConnell and his Senate GOP leadership team were to meet Monday behind closed doors as they assess their next step. Announcing a nominee on Friday or Saturday would leave less than 40 days for the Senate to hold a confirmation vote before the election. No nominee has won confirmation that quickly since Sandra Day O'Connor became the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court in 1981. O'Connor was confirmed 99-0 just over a month after she was nominated by President Ronald Reagan. The president confirmed Monday that among the top contenders are Indiana's Amy Coney Barrett and Florida's Barbara Wagala, both apparent appellate court justices he appointed. Barrett has long been a favorite among conservatives, while Lagona has been pushed by some aides who tout her political advantage of being Hispanic and hailing from the key battleground state of Florida. Trump also insinuated that Allison Jones Rushing, a 38-year-old appointed judge from North Carolina, is on his short list. He promised to nominate a woman to the high court, adding that his preference for someone younger who could hold the seat for decades. As the Senate returned to Washington on Monday, focused on Republicans Mitt Romney from Utah and Chuck Grassley from Iowa for clues to whether Trump or Ann McConnell will be able to confirm Ginsburg's replacement anytime soon. A day earlier, Biden had urged Republicans to join Murkowski and Collins in opposing a confirmation vote before November 3rd elections. It takes four GOP senators to break rank to keep Trump's nominee off the court. Uphold your constitutional duty, your consciousness, said Biden, speaking in Philadelphia on Sunday. Let the people speak. Cool the flames that have engulfed our country. Jamming the nomination through, Biden said, would amount to an abuse of power. The sudden vacancy is reshaping a presidential race, which to this point had been a larger referendum how Trump managed the COVID-19 pandemic. It is certain to electrify both sides. Democrats were breaking fundraising records while a packed Trump crowd in North Carolina loudly chanted, "Fill the seat," but it remains unclear if the high bench vacancy, which could impact everything from abortion rights to legal challenges of the 2020 election, would persuade disenchanted Republicans to return to Trump or fire up women or suburban voters to break from Biden. Republicans hold 53-47 edge in the Senate, and there was a 50-50 tie. It could be broken by Vice President Mike Pence. There's another political potential wrinkle. Because Arizona Senate race is a special election, the seat could be filled as early as November 30th. If Democrat Mark Kelly wins and is seated, that would narrow the window for Mitch McConnell. Most Republicans concur on the need for speed, and one named a particular reason. The 9-member court, argued Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, must be full if called upon to decide the outcome of a disrupted presidential election. But Biden and other Democrats said voters should choose the next president, who should in turn pick Ginsburg's successor. Healthcare, abortion rights, and religious freedoms are all on the line, they said. Biden, who has run on uniting the country after Trump's divisive tenure, warned against more upheaval. The last thing we need is a constitutional crisis to plunge us deeper into the abyss and deeper into darkness, he said, acknowledging that if Trump wins, his pick should be approved. But Biden added, if I win this election, President Trump's nominee should be withdrawn, and as the new president, I should be the one to nominate Justice Ginsburg's successor. Our next story is Harrison County reports COVID-19 outbreak at long-term care facility by Mike Brownlee. Harrison County Public Health has reported a COVID-19 outbreak at the long-term care facility in the county. The county and Iowa Department of Public Health reported 12 cases, 10 among residents and 2 among staff. At Rose Vista Home, the facility is located in Woodbine. In the release, Harrison County Public Health said the facility notified residents and their families and are consistent with state guidelines. The affected residents are isolated. 2 of the individuals are currently hospitalized. Rose Vista staff are working closely with IDPH and Harrison County Public Health to protect the health of all our residents and staff, with additional testing of residents and staff as directed by IDHP, the county department said in a release. Protecting the health and well-being of residents and staff is one of our highest Priorities. Harrison County Public Health Director Brad Bake said in a release, "We know our older population is at high risk for serious COVID illness, so we are monitoring the situation carefully and taking the highest precautions. The team at Rose Vista has been continually contracted with us, and IDPH is diligently working to limit spread. There were 181 cases out of 2,544 tests in Harrison County as of Monday afternoon. According to coronavirus.iowa.gov, there has been 152 recoveries in the county and 2 deaths. The county's 14-day rolling average positivity rate was 4.9 Monday afternoon. On Monday, Pottawatomie County surpassed the 2,000 positive cases. The county has had 2,001 cases out of 20,272 tests as of 3 p.m. Tuesday. The state COVID-19 website said there has been 1,615 recoveries. The county was at 1,938 cases at 3 o'clock p.m. on Friday. The state cited listed 37 deaths. Pottawatomie County Public Health said it Monday it is still working with the state to verify the deaths. Pottawatomie County 14-day rolling average positive rate is 10.7%. The county was at 10.6% on Friday. The Iowa reported 80,740 cases out of 741,945 tests Monday afternoon. According to coronavirus.iowa.gov, there has been 1,274 deaths and 57,942 recoveries. The state remains in top 10 in cases per 100,000 population over 7 days in the New York Times COVID-19 tracker. Iowa was 7th at 182 per every 100,000 cases on Monday. Pottawatomie County was at 185 per 100,000, putting it at the 41st highest out of 99 counties. Among Iowa Western Community Colleges, 5,100 students, there has been 15 new COVID-19 cases, 12 recoveries, and 7 active cases. For the third straight week, the 700 staff members of colleges remain free from COVID-19. There was no new cases among staff members, no recoveries, and no active cases during the period of September 13th to September 19th, according to Don Coolers, Vice President of Marketing and Public Relations. The number of positive cases among the students is up from the 4 active cases among students during the reported period of September 6th to September 12th. The students who have tested positive or have been with someone who has tested positive are asked to submit a COVID-19 form to notify Iowa Western. The college has set aside apartment buildings and separate wings in Reviver Suite 1 and 2 for students in quarantine. If a student is in quarantine or isolated, it does not necessarily mean the student has tested positive. It means the student has been exposed to someone with the virus or is experiencing symptoms to those of the COVID-19 illness. Our next story is Jake Gardner, shook up by incident in James Sherlock's death, kills himself. By Todd Cooper. The surreal and sordid ordeal involving a white Omaha bar owner and a young black Omaha man ended Sunday with a staggering development. Jake Gardner, awaiting arrest after a grand jury in Omaha, indicted him last week, shot himself outside of a medical clinic in suburban Portland, Oregon. Two law enforcement officers told the World Herald the police in Hillsboro, Oregon, found a 38-year-old former Marine dead from self-inflicted gunshot wounds around 12:20 p.m. Gardner's attorney, Stu Doran, and Tom McGowan said Gardner shot himself the day he had said he would surrender in connection with the manslaughter and three other felony charges stemming from a May 30th confrontation that led to the death of 22-year-old James Gerlach. Now both men are dead by the same hands. Sunday, Dorman and Mugahan blamed Gardner's apparent suicide on a cocktail of behavioral health problems stemming from the head trauma he experienced during military service, the belief that people were out to kill him, and incidental rush of judgment by social media jockeys. In the first public comment since the May 30th shooting, the Omaha attorney, both former and prosecutor, revealed that their client had suffered two dramatic brain injuries while serving two tours in Iraq, injuries that netted him Social Security disability payments. They said the bar owner, who was posted on Facebook the weekend of May 30th, that he was going downtown to pull a military-style fire watch, felt like he was in a warlike environment during the chaos that engulfed downtown Omaha that night. Morgans alleged that after Gardner shot and killed Skirlock, people sent Gardner death threats on social media by texting to Gardner's personal cell phone, though Mugahan later acknowledged that he didn't think the threats were credible enough to report law enforcement. Donner and Douglas County attorney Don Cui, who defended Dorian in 2006 to become county attorney, had made the right call in ruling Gardner's actions justified. Gardner had claimed that Skirdwalk had him in a chokehold and wouldn't let go, despite Gardner's repeated pleas to get off me. At the end of an 18-second struggle, Gardner switched the gun in his left hand and fired over his shoulder, killing Skirlock. Grand jurors, under the guidance of special prosecutors, ruled out self-defense as a justification. The bottom line, Dorian and Morgan said, Gardner has lost his bars, his home, and his livelihood, and that he was about to lose his freedom. Adding behavioral health concerns, Dorian said, and suicide was not a surprise. Even though his attorney fully expected him to turn himself in Sunday night, Morgan said Gardner did not leave a suicide note. I had the opportunity to talk with Mr. Gardner before his return, and he was really shook up, Dorian said. The grand jury indictment was a shock to him. It was a shock to us. It was a shock to many people. Justice Wayne, an attorney from the Skirlock family, said it wouldn't have been appropriate to comment so soon after Gardner's death. The Skirlocks, including Skirlock's father, possessing what a death meant for their quest for justice, Wayne said. Special Prosecutor Fred Franklin, who delivered news from Gardner's suicide to Morgan on Sunday, could not be reached for comment. Dispatcher audio posted by Omaha Scanner Twitter account has a Hillsboro police officer summing up the 911 call that eventually would lead them to Gardner's body. Dad confirmed that Jake had a gun and Jake usually kept it in his room, but the dad was unable to find it. This deadly turn came after a strange week in which Franklin announced late Thursday afternoon that a grand jury, which met for a week, had filed four charges against Gardner: manslaughter, attempted first-degree assault, terrorist threats, and weapon use. If convicted, Gardner would have been facing up to 95 years in prison. After his announcement of changes, Franklin could be heard talking to Dorian outside of Douglas County Courthouse, apparently trying to make arrangements to have Gardner turn himself in. Dorian said that it was the right call, that raging wildfires had forced Gardner to evacuate the North Californian area and where he had been living since the shooting. His attorneys were struggling to find an airport from which he could depart until Gardner made it to the Portland area. Questions and criticisms mounted as the week wore on and Gardner remained free. Franklin, a retired U.S. Army attorney, later told others that he accustomed that the federal system would, which defense are often allowed to turn themselves in after the incident is issued. In Omaha Area Court, the Metro Area Fugitive Task Force typically finds and arranges for the arrest of those sought on warranty. The task force just did so in a double homicide case, securing an arrest of a suspect in Texas. In a Twitter thread on Wednesday night, Wayne questioned what was going on. Friday, Douglas County District Judge James Gleason approved a warrant signing off on the arrest of Effort, spelled out by retiring Omaha Police Detective Jeff Grassway, one of the investigations in the grand jury case. But he signed only the evident portion of the warrant. He did not sign the actual warrant. Court officials said that we're having trouble processing the actual warrant. One of the problems, such a warrant usually processed through the clerks at the county office with the help of Douglas County Attorney's Office. Neither office was involved in the process of this warrant. Instead, the warrant was processed through Douglas County District Court instead of Douglas County Court, which is where it typically happens. You're listening to the Council Bluff Daily Radio Non-Peril for September 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. My name is Harrison Futrell from Drake University. IRS volunteers love to hear from you, listeners. If you have any comments about this or any IRIS programs, please call the toll-free number from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Now we move on to today's obituaries. Nancy J. Spires Dismore, age 39, of Missouri Valley, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, September 19th, 2020, at Longview Nursing Home in Missouri Valley. Nancy is preceded in death by her husband, Gene, her parents, Roy C. and Ellen Spires, her in-laws, Don and Phyllis Dismore, brother and sister-in-law, Robert and Roberta Spires, brother-in-law Donald Burtson, and in-laws Marvin and Violet Dismore. She survived by her children, Cherry Brown, and husband Kurtz of Bella Plains, Iowa, Chris Dismore of Missouri Valley, Chad and Patty Dismore of Urbandale, Iowa, her grandchildren, Jessica Dakota Whitehowl of Missouri Valley, Nolan Madison Brown of Tiffin, Iowa, Holly Dustin Kriegel of Hartwick, Iowa, Bailey Dismore of County Bluffs, Austin Brown of Belle Plains, and Colin and Graham Dismore of Urbandale. Her great-grandchildren, Joseph Whitehowl, Zoe Kriegel, and Cameron Brown. She is also survived by sisters and brother-in-law, Loretta Burtson of Missouri Valley, and Judy and Jerry Gunan of Mobile, Alabama. Her in-laws, Jim and Linda Dismore, of Boyer, Nebraska, Linda and Jerry Summers of Missouri Valley, Patty and John Silvitz of Missouri Valley, and Randy Dismore of Omaha. There will be a visitation for Nancy on Thursday, September 22nd, from 4 o'clock p.m. until 7 o'clock p.m. at Heinz Reeve Funeral Home in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Funeral service from 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020, Christian Church in Missouri Valley, Iowa. The next obituary is for Ramon Jacobo. Part of the charm of Raymond Jacobo, whose grocery store near 24th and L Street, is that you never knew who you might meet waiting in line to buy its homemade salsa. Raymond's had a real affinity for business, but he really opened up when others reached out to him, said a longtime friend, Jose Francisco Garcia of the Mexican-American Historical Society. I would look forward to waiting in line because I would meet all kinds of people, European-Americans, Mexican-Americans, Asian-Americans, and pretty soon we'd be talking and laughing. For 44 years, that Jacobi Grocery Deli has provided enchiladas, fajitas, beans, rice, tortillas, salsa, and tamales made from traditional family recipes. It's all came together under Ramon's watchful eye. My father was tireless, and he expected us to be tireless too, Dr. Martha Jacobi of Omaha said. My dad left us an understanding of giving your best at whatever you do, to be honest, and know that there is always something else to be done. The tireless store owner came to his final rest on September 13th, when he died at age 19 of natural causes in Omaha Hospital. The family held a celebration for his life at a local mortuary. My dad would have been really humbled to know so many people really enjoyed all the things created by him, Martha said. He felt so lucky to have all the attention over the years regarding the grocery store. Jacobi was born in Omaha in 1930 after his parents had immigrated from Mexicana, Mexico for work. The Depression caused the family to move back to Mexico, where Jacob married his wife, Karina, 68 years ago next month. The Jacobis later moved to Chicago's South Side, where he worked 20 years at an appliance factory, and his wife operated a small grocery store. They saw an opportunity to open a larger store in Omaha and moved here in 1976, their daughter said. Jacobi opened 6330 South 30th Street and later added a bakery at 24th and B Street. In 1989, Jacobi combined the store and bakery at the present location. He really filled a need, Garcia said. My wife and I moved to Omaha in 1976, too. We looked all over the store to introduce our children to authentic Mexican product, and Ramon had everything we needed. Martha said the family was fairly mystifying when demand for their mother's salsa created a surge in the early 1990s. Lines, especially for the regular style salsa, regularly snaked out the door. All of a sudden, people were coming in to get the salsa for parties and for their workplaces, she said. People had tried to replicate it, but they just can't. It's just so good. People often ask why Jacobi's didn't open another location, his daughter said. Customers from smaller towns make regular trips to South Omaha store. One location was a lot of work, Martha said. Dad wanted the store to be managed his way. He didn't want to move out of South Omaha because the community had embraced and a store somewhere else would have lost something. In addition to his wife and daughter, Jacobi survived by his son, Jose of Glen Ellen, Illinois, Carlos and Alfred, both of Omaha, and six grandchildren, Carlos Jr., Fernando, Manuel, Carla, and Sarah and Danielle. Okay, and now we move on to sports, which this first one is called Unmask NFL Finds Coaches and Teams Not for Covering Faces by Arianda Stapleton. NFL coaches thumbed their collective and exposed noses at FNL's mask mandate in week 2. the league responded with a hefty fine of $100,000 per coach and $250,000 per club. The first three to get fined were Denver's Vic Fangio, San Francisco's Kyle Shanahan, and Seattle's Peter Carlos, according to a person with knowledge of the punishment who spoke with the Associated Press. On conditions of anonymity between the coaches were not identified. The punishments were met out a week after the NFL reminded team personnel on the sideline about the rules for wearing face coverings during the coronavirus pandemic, lest they put the fledgling season at risk. Most coaches and clubs can expect similar punishments as memos last week from Tony Vincent, who oversaw the league's football operation, was largely ignored throughout the weekend. Among other offenders, Patriots coach Bill Belichick and his offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels, chief defensive coordinator Steve Spicuolo, Colts coach France Rich, and Rams coach Sean McVay capped a weekend of defiance and or disobedience. Raiders coach John Gruden, who was said last week that he felt Vincent's memo was directed at him, and Saint coach Sean Payton were shown on a split screen Monday night, both of them breaking the rules. Following the Raiders' 34-24 win over the Saints, Gruden revealed he had COVID-19 and apologized for violating the rules. "I'm doing my best," Gruden said. "I had the virus. I'm doing my best. I'm very sensitive about it. I'm calling the plays. I apologize. If I get fined, I will pay the fine." The scene was similar Sunday with head coaches and assistants apparently finding it too hard to keep their faces covered, as required under the league's COVID-19 protocols, with either masks, garters, or face shields. Players who, like the coaches, are subject to daily COVID-19 tests are exempt from the face covering requirements. Some coaches, such as Belichick, McDaniels, and Steelers coach Mike Tomlin, wore their mask or grimace over their mouths but not their nose. Others, such as Carlos, Sprungnell, and Fangio, wore their face coverings around their chin or neck, exposing both their mouth and their nose. In his strongly worded memo, Vincent said teams must remain vigilant and disciplined, following the process and protocols put in place not only by the league, union, and club, but also by the state and local government. Vincent added, "Becoming careless and ignoring face coverings and physical distance requirements will put the 2020 season at risk. The rules do not apply to players, but all individuals with bench area access, including coaches, members of the club medical staff, are required to wear face coverings at all times. Failure to do so," Vincent warned in his memo, "would result in accountability measurements being imposed against offending individuals and or clubs. The face covering must be worn and designed so that it securely fits around the wearer's nose and mouth to prevent the transmission of the virus." Next story is "Big Night for Las Vegas Raiders in Their New Hometown" by Tim Dahlenberg. As the light outside faded, the glistening casino on the Las Vegas Strip came to life Monday evening through the giant Almaty doors in the new home of the Raiders. If the backdrop was spectacular, so was the scene on the field. There were Raiders players The Raiders were playing the New Orleans Saints before the national television audience. A moment in a late Howard Coulson would have never imagined when Monday Night Football kicked off exactly half a century earlier. No one else would have imagined it would be taking place before or 65,000 empty seats. But that's sports during a pandemic. Not only were fans missing, at least indoors, but so were many Raiders owners. Mark Davis, who expressed his solidarity with this city by watching it on TV with other team executives at the Raiders practice facility. His mother, Carol, was there leading a ceremonial lighting of a giant torch honoring her late husband, Al. So was NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who just a few years ago was threatening to suspend any player who might even accidentally enter a casino in this gambling town. And everything in the sparkling new $2 billion Allegiant Stadium screamed the silver and black. Even if there was no actual fan there, the scream to scream for the team. Best of all, the town that loves a winner got one. Raiders overcame an early 10-0 deficit to dominate most of the rest of the way, beating Drew Brees and the New Orleans Saints 34-25. And in turn, in true Las Vegas fashion, Coach John Green compared it to the kind of big event Las Vegas was known for before it landed an NFL team. "We knew it was going to be a 15-round fight here tonight," he said. "You just gotta keep swinging against New Orleans because they have the heart of champions." The newest shot just off the strip at the corner of Al Davis Way and Dean Martin Drive was an instant hit, with Derek Carr and tight end Darren Waker playing pitch and catch most of the night, and the Raiders controlling the time of possession. Josh Jacob ran for 88 yards, and Daniel Carlson kicked a 58-yard field goal in with 1 minute and 50 seconds left to cling to a win. Both bookies just down the street had made home team 4-point underdogs. Fighting the Raiders' defense was going to have trouble stopping Breeze, but you only get to open at home once, and the Raiders weren't going to be denied this night. Outside of the stadiums, fans parked cars anywhere they could and joined at fences to watch on their phones and cheer for their new team. At halftime, the Killers rocked them and the nation from the rooftop of nearby Caesar Palace. Oakland and its aging stadium suddenly felt like a very long time ago. "We had a great fan base and they're out there in the streets proving it," Grundel said. "I just hope they're wearing masks. If they did, they were paying more attention to health guidelines than Gruden. He's paced the sidelines with his mask low much of the game, not covering anything but his chin despite NFL warning guidelines. I've had the virus and I'm doing my best," Grund said, seeing that trouble calling players with mask on. "I'm very sensitive about it and I'll apologize." For a while, it looked like Gunner might have to apologize for the plays of his team too, but after a slow start, Raiders are now 2-0 on the younger season and 1-0 in the stadium. Mark Davis dubbed the Death Star because that's where the other team's chance to win died. Carr said that team had bonded quickly with its new home and knew that significance of winning it in the first game in Las Vegas. "We want to emulate what Las Vegas has been and what we feed on each other," he said. It's hard not to feel the energy in the stadium, but trust me, just being a part of this community and going home every night, we feel it. On this night, the feeling was good for both the Raiders and their fans. The Raiders, or any other NFL team, makes its home as Las Vegas was once an unimaginable, but now it is finally a reality. It may be the perfect marriage of rebel team in the city has always flaunted the rules. The Raiders have embraced Las Vegas, and the city is loving them back. Okay, this next one is, Tokyo needs to convince sponsors Olympics will really happen. The only thing more difficult than staging next year's Tokyo Olympics in the pandemic is might be convincing the sponsors to keep their $1 billion on board in the midst of an economic turbulence and skepticism. To make this the point of the week, IOC President Thomas Blatch will join a number of Japanese government and city officials, local organizers, and other top International Olympic Committee leaders in repeating a message they failed to convey forcefully enough to deep-pocketed sponsors. Trust us, the Tokyo Olympics will open on July 23rd, 2021. Beck and IOC Vice President Josh Kowitz, who oversaw Tokyo's preparations, are expected to speak remotely to Japanese officials as they met on Thursday and Friday. The agenda included plotting countermeasures against COVID's quarantine rules, rules of athletes entering the country, testing and vaccinating, the presence of absent fans. Few firm details are expected to be until late in the year or early 2021, which accounts for the uncertainty. The subtext is assuming sponsors of the Olympics will happen. Tokyo Organization Committee CEO Toroshi Muto has acknowledged the world's not getting out. The fact that Olympics are going to take place, the fact itself is not fully distributed to the public, Muto said. Speaking in Japanese, said last week, people need to be more convinced that, yes, the Olympics will be taking place for sure. A former deputy governor of the Bank of Japan, Muto has been vague about how many domestic sponsors and renewing their contract. He said of the 68 sponsors, they're all positive. We're still in the midst of negotiations, but not in the phase of speaking about any concrete results, he said. Surveys have shown the majority of Japanese companies and the public don't think the Olympics will happen next year or should happen. A poll published in July by Japanese broadcaster NHK said two-thirds of sponsors were undecided about extending for another year. Keeping domestic sponsors on board is financially critical. Recruiting by a giant Japanese advertising agency, Dentsu Inc., domestic sponsors have paid a record $3.3 billion at least twice any previous Olympics to the local organization committee. This is over and above a dozen permanent Olympic sponsors who have signed a long-term contract with IOC. Some also have individual contracts with Tokyo organizers. John Grady, who teaches sports law at the University of South Carolina, said the postponement has created countless problems and ripple effects. With the uncertainty of the Tokyo Games, with few or limited fans, local sponsors would be right to be cautious and investing more sponsorship dollars if they cannot reach the fans. Grady wrote in an email that the Associated Press, the lack of wilder international fan base is typical, and an Olympic would shrink in the global audience would have access to see local sponsors' activation efforts around Olympic venues in the host city. Despite the uncertainty, it would be difficult for sponsors to step away in a country where conformity and teamwork are valued and national loyalty could be called into question. Japan has a long history of supporting the Olympics, and many in decision-making roles recalled fondly the positive impact of the 1964 Tokyo Games, which showed the country's rebirth just 19 years after the defeat in World War II. There is a strong underlying narrative that the event is really good for the country, Robert Kinsley, who teaches and researches Japan's sports and history at LaGrandia Community College in New York said in an interview with AP, "I think there's more about historical parachute to have gone smoothly and to benefit Japan in some way," she said, "whether that's financially or whether it's getting their company seen. There's something, too, about the rising China, and especially compared to 1964, how Japan is somewhat in the shadow of a huge economy next door." Japan organizers say little about how the 15,400 Olympic and Paralympic athletes, staff, and officials will be safe in Tokyo. The event will come to the environment when it comes to Tokyo will be different than from the environment today, Batch said. "We only do not know in which ways." Batch said that even in rapid tests and vaccines were available, they would not be a silver bullet. A study last week from the University of Oxford shows that Tokyo to be the most expensive Summer Olympics dating from 1960, and the matter is still running. Kudio's new agency reported again this week on more details about bribery scandals that seem to have helped Tokyo land the Olympics. David Lennon, who teaches politics as Japan's Waseda University, suggests hard-fought takes are taking places with sponsors. "My guess is that there will be around negotiating for light sponsorship contracts with firms holding most of the cards and on the terms if they remain coercive," when he said in an email. "The organizations don't want to give up any sponsors, but also don't want to look exploited like exponential bullies in the midst of a pandemic / recession. None wants to be the first to be seen as abandoning them." And that brings us to the end of today's reading on the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 22nd. The Nonpareil can be heard every week at 3 p.m. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any IRIS programs, please call the toll-free number from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Harrison Futrell from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. An article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous Manna Colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles, but unlike the Icarians, the Mannas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. Adherents to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration formed their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843 to 44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. The leaders chose the name Amana, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Amana, East Amana, West Amana, South Amana, High Amana, and Middle Amana. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Amana colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Amana, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Amana Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the village council of brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. Well-crafted products became a hallmark of the Amana colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Amana, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Amana colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Amana village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Amana colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Amana colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Amana socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Amana set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colonies Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and established the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Yamana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Yamana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Yamana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Yamana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Yamana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Yamana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Yamana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Yamana colonies. With the passing of the Old Order in 1932, the number of the Society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth-generation South Yamana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Yamana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Yamana colonies showcase his cottage in the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Yamana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from a culinary history of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.